wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this December 16th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. KBOO is an independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered radio station. By making a donation through GiveGuide on kboo.fm/give, you are eligible for over $4,000 worth of free and discounted products from your favorite Portland brands. Again, that is GiveGuide on kboo.fm/give. This morning on The Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews Brian Tokar. He's an activist, author, and lecturer in environmental studies at the University of Vermont. Brian Tokar was a representative of the Institute for Social Ecology in the North American Congress that founded the North American organization Symbiosis. It's a confederation of community organizations seeking to build a democratic and ecological society from the ground up. Desiree Helger speaks with Lakota Cheyenne activist and Old Mole member Robin White and Shelley Sansosi. She is a Yankton Sioux tribal member and vice chair of the White Sawn community and director of Tribal Employment Rights Office. They're going to get an update on the conditions on the South Dakota reservation, which continues to be impacted by flooding and neglect by state and federal government. We'll conclude today's show with a discussion of the Irishman. Labor unions, corruption, and capitalism will be on tap as I will be joined by Victoria Saucedo and Mark Brenner. We'll talk a roundtable about Martin Scorsese's latest film. Much controversy and a lot of acclaim. We'll figure out where we stand. Okay, now we're going to go to Bill Resnick and Brian Tokar.
Hi, Brian Tokar. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Great to be here.
Brian Tokar is an activist, an author, a lecturer in environmental studies at the University of Vermont, an active board member of 350 Vermont, and the Institute for Social Ecology. More on them later. His books include The Green Alternative, Earth for Sale, Towards Climate Justice, also Agriculture and Food in Crisis, and is now working on Climate Justice and Community Renewal, Campaigns and Strategies from the Front Lines. He was the director of the Institute for Social Ecology. He remains on the board. The Institute, ISE, Institute for Social Ecology, had an important role in founding an organization. It's named Symbiosis, which is a confederation of community organizations across North America that seeks to build a democratic and ecological society from the ground up. That is, building the movements, radically democratic, fighting for a better world by creating institutions of participatory democracy and solidarity economy, that is, city by city, neighborhood by neighborhood. So, Brian Tokar, expand on Symbiosis, on their struggles, their efforts, especially the idea of dual power and ultimately a new democratic society.
Sure. Well, to step back a minute, over the last 3 or 4 years, we've had an influx of many more activists, current activists, brilliant young activists coming to various programs and gatherings of the Institute. And at an event in San Francisco about 2.5 years ago, some folks from actually out there in the Northwest and also from the Midwest had some conversations and realized that they were doing some very similar things based on some very similar principles. And the core group that founded Symbiosis per se initially started as a research group. They won a big essay contest that was put out by the Next System Project, which has people like Gar Alperovitz and Gus Speth and other somewhat well-known people.
Joanna Buzua, who we'll interview I've interviewed a couple times on electricity systems.
Right. And they put forward a very expansive vision of communities organizing along a model of models of direct democracy and confederation based on the strategy that we've been talking about in the social ecology world for a number of decades. Of course, Murray Bookchin wrote some of the original essays that inspired that vision. And now there's a whole generation of young activists that are really, for the first time in this part of the world anyway, there have been some earlier experiments in Europe, but the first time in this part of the world really taking steps to put that theory into practice. And they started meeting with a plan to have a continental congress of directly democratic, municipally based movements. And that Congress happened this past late September. It happened at an old college campus that's currently no longer active as a college in the middle of Detroit. And it brought together people from about 30 different groups, plus lots of freelance individuals, and through a whole structure that actually represented people as at-large delegates and encouraged people to develop and work further with these organizing models in their communities coming out of the Congress. And it was a pretty amazing gathering. There were 150 people there all together, a mix of delegates from organizations, at-large delegates, sponsoring organizations, supported.
Give us a little sense of who they were, and also give us a sense of what we mean by institution buildings. What are those on the ground, the solidarity economy, working in democratic ways, but in what sorts of institutions are we talking about, like cooperative?
They're mostly grassroots organizing initiatives, working in cities and neighborhoods, governed through principles of direct democracy, and drawing upon the co-op movement, drawing upon various political organizing efforts, a lot of energy, of course, that came out of the inauguration of Trump at the beginning of 2017, where there were meetings in communities all over the country trying to figure out what to do and how to organize. And a lot of people realizing that the more democratic our own organizations in our own neighborhoods are, the more they can prefigure a model for a different kind of political order and a different kind of society rooted in direct democracy on the political level, solidarity economy and cooperative organization in economic terms, and trying to build a movement and a network that can really much more forthrightly address the challenges of political and economic power in the current context.
Yeah, let's just name some of the kinds of things that make for a solidarity economy when, in fact, they have, instead of profit-making, the support of all of their workers as a goal, having to be able to have shelter and food, which they struggle to do cooperatively. But we have groceries, right? We have all sorts of bookstores, and farms. It seems to me, automobile repair things, bicycle repair, on and on. These are actually economic organizations that operate and are in the cash and even credit economy, and yet they're radically democratic.
Right, and there's a mix of governance models. Some are mostly consumer co-ops that are governed by members who buy food or whatever other commodities. Some are primarily worker co-ops. Others are hybrids of the two. There are housing co-ops, which is a model that's much better developed in Canada than here in the U.S., but we have some interesting models in that sector here.
Yeah, there are restaurants, coffee houses, bars, entertainment venues. It seems to me almost all sort of things that people need on a local level can be provided by cooperative enterprises, and they're not a huge part of the economy, but they're relatively stable, and in almost every city of the United States, even people who don't see themselves as particularly as leftists, they're living like that.
That's right, and we have models from other parts of the world of cooperatively run manufacturing industries. I think of the wave of worker takeovers of industries that happened in Argentina less than 20 years ago, and we believe the whole economy can ultimately be run that way.
Brian, tell us about the strategy of dual power and ultimately the consolidation of these many efforts, and then the choice of the people that this is the way we want our economy to work, rather than the maintenance of these top-down predatory structures.
Sure. The idea of dual power has been around on the left for many decades, but it's really been a while since it's been a centerpiece of conversation. And one of the points Murray Bookchin often made in his lectures, especially in his later years, was that in recent decades, the left has really shied away from questions of power. And in Murray's view, there's an inherent tension between the aspirations of people in communities and the centralized powers of capitalism and the state. And dual power strategy that's proposed by Symbiosis proposes that we can create institutions of real democracy where we live and work, and develop institutions at the grassroots level that can ultimately be engaged in municipal politics, in Bookchin's vision, ultimately restructure cities as confederations of directly democratic neighborhood organizations. And then people are starting to think about, through structures like Symbiosis, how to organize beyond the local and start developing confederations, in this case, across the entire continent, based on these shared values, based on some very specific shared principles, and I can get into that in a bit. We've kind of begun since the Congress to pare it down to 10 core principles that were agreed to by those present in Detroit, and really mount a fundamental challenge to the institutions that currently run the society and whose interest in being accountable in any meaningful way to people in their communities is disappearing very quickly.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Brian Tokar. Brian's an activist, he's a writer, he's on the board of a variety of organizations, he's active on the ground, he also writes books. Brian and I have been discussing a newly funded national organization, Symbiosis, that through community organizing builds a solidarity economy and participatory democracies, and that's right in the belly of the beast, creating a situation of dual power and ultimately a democratic society. I think that's conceivable because at some point a great national crisis, the climate scientists say that is very likely if the powers that be do not change most everything, and they are clearly not ready to do that and will not do it.
Yeah, and the extremes of political and economic disempowerment that we see across the country now is driving people into the hands of the right because the left is not very well organized. It's not visible in most communities around the country. People are desperate for a way out of the morass that they find themselves in the current economic situation. And now's the time when people really need to be active and organizing and visible.
Yeah, and building that contending force. It's all quite possible, it seems to me. Brian, the one part of the Symbiosis statement gave me pause. Let me read it to you. We need be organizing society in parallel against capitalism and the state. You know, it seems to me that's overbroad. It dismisses all the institutions of the state that would be our natural partners and, in fact, partly share our vision. And it also ignores the kind of state that we're living under. It seems to me that we should be concentrating on, that we have to concentrate on dealing with the most repressive institutions and changing them and at least neutralizing them, or we are finished and the planet is finished. Anyway, why don't you respond to that?
Sure. 2 points on that. First, this is a conversation we've been having for a number of years in the social ecology realm. We've struggled with this question for quite a long time. In social ecology's outlook on political strategy, we do honor the public sphere and the public sector of the economy. Those are aspects of life that need to be strengthened. And the big question for really anti-authoritarian political strategy in general is, how can we separate those positive social institutions,
like schools and public health clinics and many, many others, in many places, municipal electricity companies? There are all sorts of state institutions that, in fact, operate on different principles than the capitalist economy.
Yeah, and I would emphasize public institutions. And the question is, can we find a way to meaningfully separate the public institutions that we know we need to strengthen from the military and police powers that have been classically associated with the institutions of the state? And this is a debate that's happening globally. I was at a big European social ecology conference in Athens just a couple of months ago, and people from Southern Europe there were pointing out that there's even a debate between people with basically shared principles in Northern Europe versus Southern Europe, where in the northern tier countries, like in Scandinavia and to some extent in Germany, although it's more contested there, the state has supported socially responsible and socially beneficial structures of the public sector that people generally support and feel that they are supported by. Whereas across most of Southern Europe, the state is kind of a shambles, and its repressive side is much more blatant and much more apparent. And even within many European societies, there are class divisions, even on the left, in terms of people's attitudes about the state, where, you know, people who are more middle class and more comfortable see the state more in terms of the institutions that support the society as a whole and that help strengthen the public sphere. And poor folks are generally on the receiving end of the repressive side of the state. So this is a basic theoretical question among folks who support a more liberatory and more directly democratic political vision. How can we further the public sphere without strengthening what is classically identified with the state and all its negative qualities? And of course, the state here in the U.S. is extremely militarized. The military budget, we all know, is typically at least half of all public spending in this country, and we can't do anything about the fundamental social problems that we face, especially huge ones like the climate crisis, without doing something about the way our public expenditures are currently so heavily dominated by the military.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole talking to Brian Tokar. You can find his work. Where should people look? The Institute for Social Ecology has some of it. What's your sense, Brian?
Ecology.org. There's a page there where you can find my past books and articles and things.
There's so many organizations in Portland and around the country that are not members right now of Symbiosis, but who share its vision and who are challenging the repressive organizations of the state, like in fact the contract fight with the police and the city, who are intervening in the contract fight. You'll hear a lot more about that on KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour. In fact, there's this struggle against the repressive state, and there's also a struggle to build community organizations of various kinds that work. And they muddle through democratically. They have democratic aspirations. They're also working in a society where a lot of people are very discouraged. I'm not sure what to do. But it seems to me that those ideals are, in fact, still really motivating people, and aspirations for a democratic society are shared by majority of the population.
I know in Portland there was an effort back in 2017 to create a citywide Portland assembly on this model, and there were some problems along the way, and I'm not sure if that work continues, but that was really one of the efforts that inspired people to help build Symbiosis as a national network of people with these values. There's a continuing group in Portland called Demand Utopia that folks might be familiar with, and I would encourage you to talk to some of those folks about how they view some of the local issues in terms of this broader strategy put forward by the Symbiosis Federation. The younger activists now have a really unique and really inspiring handle on how the pieces come together and the potential for realizing this vision in the current setting.
Yeah, it's very widespread among the young, and now left organizations like the Democratic Socialists of America are now very, very strong and influenced greatly by the radically democratic left. Brian Tokar, really good talking to you.
Really good. Thanks, Bill.
So long.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. That's listener-supported community radio. Later in our program, labor unions, corruption, and capitalism will be on tap with Victoria Saucedo, Mark Brenner, and myself, Denise Morris. We'll be talking about Martin Scorsese's latest film, The Irishman. Next up on the Old Mole, we have Desiree Helligers with our newest Old Mole member, Robin White, and they will be talking with Shelley Sassosi about what's happening in South Dakota on the reservations, continued flooding, and the neglect by the state and the federal government. Desiree.
So my guest today is Shelley Sassosi, who is the vice chair of the White Swan community, and she is also the tribal employment rights officer on the Yankton Sioux Reservation. She's a Yankton Sioux tribal member. And I'm speaking also with Lakota Cheyenne activist and member of the Old Mole Collective, Robin White, who recently returned from a trip to the reservation and who couldn't be in the studio with us today because he's recovering from pneumonia. And we're talking about the federal and South Dakota state neglect of the Yankton Sioux Reservation, which was hit by a bomb cyclone in March and then slammed with about another 11 inches of rain in 24 hours in September. And more recently, it was hit by a winter blizzard. So before we start, I really want to refer people to some of the excellent coverage that Dena Yankton, Dakota journalist Jacqueline Keeler, who's a co-host of Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland, has provided on the crisis, and also refer people to a November 29th piece that The Guardian ran on conditions on the reservation. That piece was by Nina Lacani. So coverage by both Keeler and Lacani emphasizes the links to climate change, as well as the health impacts of standing water contaminated by E. coli and the pervasive presence of black mold, with the Indian Health Service advising people not to turn on their furnaces, even in sub-zero temperatures, to avoid spreading mold spores. Many have had to leave their homes, and or discard mold-contaminated clothing and household goods, and many children are suffering from ringworm, impetigo, and pneumonia. The Guardian quoted Tom Gilmore, a retired physician who spent 50 years working on reservations, who noted that mold kills lung tissues and repeated infections can affect child growth and development. And just want to note also that South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem has refused to deploy the National Guard despite the presence of a guard unit on the reservation about 22 miles away. So, Shelley, can you update us on some of the latest developments out there?
Yes, I want to say thank you for having me on the show today.
And thank you so much for joining us, Shelley. Thank you.
Yes. I wanted to say that within the past week, I'm talking about on the 10th of December, the emergency response team from FEMA came. That was really good because we were part of the first declaration that was passed back in October. Our reservation in our county was left out of it. So when we had talked to the governor or pleaded with the governor, had more officials come out and look at the conditions that the homes are, the mold, the water still in the basements, and some of the health issues that a lot of the children and the adults are facing, they have come and pleaded with our president, and he has signed the declaration, so we were happy for that. So one of the other big things that happened on December 6th was our highway was opened. Our highway hasn't been open since March 5th, actually. And it was open briefly for 10 days in August and September. And then when the flooding hit again, it was covered with water again, where it left kind of like a back road. It was the only way in or out for us. And it was, at times it was treacherous. Maybe like 2 weeks ago, it was so bad when the blizzard and the rain, everything came, it just washed the whole road out. And that was our only way in or out. So a lot of people couldn't get out if they had small vehicles. So we were really in celebration that our highway opened up. And how that happened was the water froze. And it's completely froze to the level of the road. And the state highway had come up and put guardrails up and opened the road. So we were really happy for that. That was one big excitement for the community. And the other is FEMA's here to help. The infrastructure of our tribal homes, the HUD homes, they're come to bring relief is what I've heard, because a lot of these homes that they had like first floor water coming in from the lake, and then that was like contaminated water because it was standing all summer and it did test positive for E. coli. So what our housing authority did was they moved out the real serious cases right away. And then as we're going along, as what I was told by one of the maintenance workers, that by the end of December or hopefully end of January, all of the people that are in the most exposed homes will be relocated to other communities on our reservation. So that doesn't bring a lot of excitement for many of them, because they're from this community and this is their home. But I tell them it's not healthy to live in that much mold. It's affecting, everybody has the respiratory virus and coughing. And then, like I said, the kids are kind of sick, you know, always on nebulizers, walking pneumonia almost every other week, barely get them well enough, and then again they're back sick into the hospital. So I tell the community members that are worried about moving, please do this for your health. You know, we're in the future, maybe we can work on something, or maybe our tribal officials are working on something where they could move back to the area. Because I've also heard when Nina Lacani from the Guardian came, I accompanied her with, when she interviewed our housing authority director, and he had kind of gave us insight of kind of what their plan was, you know, to build homes near White Swan, but up in the hills to where it wouldn't be in the flooded area. And so I told them, how long that takes, I don't know, but I advised the community tenants to move. They did receive letters that were saying that if they didn't move, then they would be evicted.
And so we're talking also... We're talking also about a community that was actually relocated to this site in 1952 following the construction of the Fort Randall Dam, which drowned the original town. And so a lot of the replacement housing that was promised when people relocated to this site was never delivered. And you were relocated, it sounds like, to a pretty flood-prone lake bed.
Yes. And then like other White Swan residents, they were, the Corps had built them homes or bought them homes in different communities, Wagner, like 15 or 20 miles away, you know. But yeah, most of this is for because of the relocation of the original White Swan. So a lot of the people, this has been their home, you know. They haven't I have a few grandmas here that are have been here since, and then they're the ones that are crying. They're the ones that don't want to leave the community. And so, but I advised them because of their health issues that they're enduring now. I told them that maybe it's a good thing until we can get the housing or the homes fixed up back over here, then they can move back over, you know. But for right now, for the health of all the mold and that's growing, you know, and the water still in their basements, just to leave for their health.
Robin, did you want to jump in? You just got back from the reservation not too long ago, and you brought a little pneumonia back with you, it sounds like.
Yeah, I wanted to share all the best, you know. So I think in particular, I think we need to recognize what this means. You know, I think Native communities in this country are the first to be affected and the worst to be affected by climate disaster. You know, here in Quinault, in Washington, in Florida, in Alaska, different places, we already see this. We see that the response by state and federal governments in particular are really substandard and almost actually putting roadblocks in the way of getting these things taken care of. Certainly in the case of White Swan, that was apparent. And you know, even the federal response, a lot of that is, you know, they'll pay you back money for that you spent. We are talking about a community that has no money to spend in the first place. So, you know, it's really, it's helping a lot of wider communities. You know, the other thing is that drainage still hasn't been taken care of. The state is responsible for part of that. I'm sure that was passed on from Army Corps of Engineers to the state. But I understand that the federal government stopped them from completing the drainage of that area. And what does that mean in the long run? You know, as soon as that snow melts it, from those blizzards or another rain hits, they're in the same boat that they have been in. It takes a long time for that water to get the saturation point out of there so that, you know, any little bit of water actually makes another flood. The constant disease state where, you know, you don't have fresh water, you don't have clean water, you don't have clothes, you don't have beds. How do you keep these kids? It's like Shelley was saying, it's just a constant battle of trying to keep those kids from dying. And it, you know, this is not acceptable in any civilization. We need to do a lot better. You know, we had a social media response from a lot of people when we had them call the state of South Dakota and the federal. A lot of federal people. We're going to have another one of those here shortly, particularly calling the Senate Indian Committee on Indian Affairs, the members of that, and, you know, really trying to move them forward on this. And we're going to try and respond with a Native FEMA, Native Red Cross, if you will, to kind of be the liaison in between organizations and people trying to get to the bottom of this and make it better in this relationship with Native communities and how they're affected.
Yeah, I just want to chime in again about the National Guard unit, which is literally just like 22 miles away from the flooded area. It's actually on the reservation and has training in, you know, flood response. They have water purification equipment, and, you know, the governor has refused to deploy them to the site.
Yeah, I would be remiss if not saying that a lot of people did step up in this. You know, LifeStraw, we approached them. They came out right off the bat with a lot of water purification units for families and for the community center. A lot of people came up with money for food and, you know, socks and things so the kids could get back to school. You know, we're still working on mattresses and so on and so forth. People did step up, and I think we should say that the state did not step up. The feds did not step up until they were kind of, I don't know, maybe shamed into it. I think that's a bad response. I'm glad they're there and thank them for being there and hope they stay there. I should also say that, you know, there is no Christmas there at this point. The rental, the police, Yankton police had an office rental there in the community center. Without that revenue, you know, the White Swan community and the community at large, the White Swan community usually puts on a big Christmas event. We'd sure appreciate if people would get on Walks on the Day on Facebook and maybe donate to that effort. These people need help, and they need long-term help. We're also trying to work on some long-term housing assistance for them and see what that means, not only on that reservation but in other reservations, because this continues to happen in this checkerboard of administrations and policies and so on and so forth, make it really difficult to live on these reservations, and particularly with the checkerboarding of ownership of non-Indians on the reservations. It's a mire, and we need to really do better for all these people.
So I just want to give our listeners some contact information for people that they can call to ask for demand, you know, more concerted aid response. So the governor of South Dakota, Kristi Noem, her phone number is 605-773-3212. That's 605-773-3212. People can call her and demand that she deploy the National Guard to the site. There's also Maria Cantwell of Washington State is on the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. Her number is 360-696-7838. That's 360-696-7838. And then the chair of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is John Hoven from North Dakota. His phone number is 701-250-4618.
So, Desiree.
Yeah. Yes, Shelley.
If I can add in, I was just, one of our former councilmen, Greg Zephyr, is here, and he would like to express his thoughts on all of this, if it's okay.
Wonderful. Yeah, great.
Okay.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes. You know what? There's this hidden, this groundwater. See, that's the hidden danger right there, because this top water, I mean, you could pump that, you know, but that groundwater has absolutely nowhere to go. And that's what's coming, that's seeping up from the bottom of the basement, on the side or whatever. These houses, you know, when you're talking about the cold weather's coming up, you know, winter or whatever, when spring comes and that melt comes, see, this community is going to be even in worse shape than it is this past year. So, you know, and the tribe is currently working on a mitigation plan, and I wish they would hurry up and kind of, you know, push that through, because, you know, there's going to be a natural disaster in the springtime that's going to be worse than it is right here now. And you're talking about Noem, you know, what I think really needs to happen is we got to call all the parties together. You know what I mean? Bring in Noem, bring in, you know, all these agencies to sit down at the table, not as politicians, but as humans, because we are humans, you know. And this community, you know, it's a, you know, we got too many people there that are, you know, that are affected by this, and with the water and like the groundwater, like I'm saying, that's what's coming up to the basement, and that's, you know, the foundations are gonna, you know, they're gonna collapse. You get that meltdown or whatever, you know.
So we have 1 minute remaining, and I'm wondering if you can tell us where folks can contribute if they want to provide, you know, aid to the location. Robin, can you tell us?
Yeah, go ahead and get on Walks on Facebook, on Walks on the Day.
Walks on the Day.
Several places that you can get money to there.
I'm so sorry to cut you off, but we are just about out of time, and we've been talking today with Shelley Sanssouci on the Yankton Sioux Reservation, and with Old Mole Collective member Robin White, and with a member of the Tribal Council out on the Yankton Sioux Reservation. So thank you so much for joining us today. And this has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning. I am joined now by Mark Brenner and Victoria Saucedo. We are winging it this morning with a review of The Irishman. We've been chatting a little bit this morning before we talk live, but are we ready, folks?
Absolutely.
Good morning.
I think we are.
Good. I feel ready. We're not going to really go too far in trying to explain to everybody what The Irishman is, because we think most people might know it. I do want to say, we believe it's a mob movie and it's not a union movie, which doesn't mean we won't have critiques about it on that front. But The Irishman is Martin Scorsese's latest film, a kind of swan song to the mob movie, starring the regular crowd of Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci. What's that other guy's name?
Al Pacino.
Harvey
Al
Keitel, as
Pacino.
Usual.
Yeah, Harvey Keitel. And so, let me start with you over here, Mark. Mark Brenner, you spent many, many years as a director of Labor Notes. You have been a labor guy for a long time. You're now at the Labor Center at the University of Oregon, which is why you're here joining us in studio, because you live in Portland now. So we're happy to have you here on our team. So as far as the Teamsters and this long history of speculation about the relationship between Teamsters and the mob and the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa, there's something inside there that is there, that is factual in terms of how the Teamsters operated and how it is that we kind of actually got to the point we are now, given that there's been more recent struggles and more concessions. And so can you talk just a little bit about the Teamsters and kind of put that piece of it on the table for us?
Sure. So I have to say, when we saw The Irishman, I was quite relieved that it was a pure and pure mob movie and not really trying to be a commentary on the Teamsters Union of the 50s and 60s and 70s. Because what was really a through line in that movie that I think resonates with a lot of the way people interpret the labor history of that time is that whether it was in the military, whether it was from the mob, whether it was from the federal government, working class folks, their job was to take orders and follow them, and that's how they were supposed to get ahead. And what it really missed in the movie and what is missing from so much of that history is, you know, not the top-down direction that came from autocratic leaders like Jimmy Hoffa, but the bottom-up inspiration and creativity and excitement and organizing that was happening at that time, at the time of the film and the civil rights movement, but even within the labor movement. I mean, we saw an explosion of Teamster activism and activity not long after, I mean, both before and not long after Jimmy Hoffa's death throughout the 70s, because so many people were interested in charting their own course and defining their own, what their own expectations were of building and participating in a democratic organization. They were fighting to maintain the standards that were won from that earlier generation, the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, the standards that people so frequently associated with leaders like Jimmy Hoffa. And that was really, to me, the thing I left the theater thinking about was, oh, wow, I want somebody to make a film about that history of the Teamsters, because it's been really inspirational. And there's no place that you can see more of a better example of that than in an organization that was founded the same year that Hoffa disappeared, Teamsters for a Democratic Union, which is a 44-year-old reform effort inside of the Teamsters Union. And there you really see the best of what Teamster activism today is, trying to channel the power that workers in that industry, in the freight and trucking and logistics industry, still have.
Now, a reviewer on The Nation points out that each time a mob movie came out starring Robert De Niro, there was an impeachment in progress. So he describes The Godfather in 1972, Godfather again in 74, Nixon resigned, and then notably Bill Clinton and his shenanigans, that was the year the Casino was released. So I thought that was kind of an interesting fun fact, because here we are now with impeachment process in progress for President Trump, and we have the Irishman. And Victoria, did you have anything to add about this labor piece that struck you?
Well, for me, the labor piece that came out was really, again, the movie focused on working class people trying to make their way in the world, albeit cut in a roundabout way. But that's what I walked away from, you know, being working class family myself, being a union family myself. I saw, I was like, oh, okay, there are people out there that are just trying to go to work while the higher ups are busy doing their thing with all the money that you're making and all the dues that you're paying. Who knows what's happening? The corruption, yeah. That's totally going past your family because you're busy trying to survive, pay your bills, put your kids through school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's Frank Sheeran, and Mark, you read the book that the film is based on, I Hear You Paint Houses. He says at the beginning of the film, I had four daughters. How do you afford to keep your family afloat? And for his path, it became involvement in the mob. His history is very important because much of his contributions were not necessarily in the best interest of working people.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have to make a public service announcement here for the general population. My greatest fear is that people are going to now, after The Irishman has been released, take I Heard You Paint Houses as the definitive book on Jimmy Hoffa's disappearance. And unfortunately, as many, many Teamster scholars and experts in the mob have documented, most of the big claims that Frank Sheeran makes, from running guns for the Bay of Pigs to killing Joey Gallo, a made guy of the five families in New York City, are pretty clearly fabrications and falsehoods. And I think that his role as trigger man in the Hoffa murder is similarly invented. It makes for great cinema. It is much less clear that it tells us the story of the Teamsters. But as you point out, I did want to say there's no doubt that infiltration of the Teamsters Union and other unions in this country in the 50s and 60s by the by organized crime was a real issue. And that's what's so unfortunate, that it stops short of talking about the sort of rank and file rebellion that took place in the union, because that is a lot of what spurred it on. Was workers who were like, we want to control our union. We don't want the mob, and we don't want autocrats like Hoffa or Fitzsimmons telling us what we are and are not going to do.
And the legacy of Hoffa lives on in, what's the son's name? Hoffa Jr.?
Hoffa Jr.
Hoffa Jr.
Hoffa Jr.
Let's just call him Hoffa Jr.
Hoffa Jr.
Yeah, he's now in his late 70s. He's been the president of the union for 20 years. He's never been a working Teamster. He makes $400,000 a year. And so it's an echo of the style of life and the sort of imperious rule of his father, but it's a very wealthy echo nonetheless. And unfortunately, under his watch, we've seen a lot of the standards that were built in the era of Hoffa Sr. Completely unraveled. But I think that we're hopeful that that's going to come to an end. Hoffa's not running again, and we expect those of us who are Teamster watchers are looking forward to seeing some change at the top of that union.
I want to move on to talk about the gender politics of the film. And there's actually two things I want to talk about. One has to do with race and the perception of Italians as white men in the minds of many reviewers. But let's table that for a second and talk about gender politics. Victoria, we've had these conversations many times about films, and this film has been critiqued, I think rightly so, on its representations of women and the force of women.
Absolutely.
However, we both agree that there are moments, there are kind of reclamation moments in the film that are important. Do you want to take that
up? Yeah, and we were talking earlier about the character that plays Buffalino's wife has this very calm, decisive moment. Joe Pesci comes home. He's
and
covered
he's
in blood.
He's the current mob boss.
Correct.
Yes.
Russell
Buffalino.
He comes home spattered in blood. It's this really kind of slow, dark scene. And his wife doesn't even bat an eyelash. She doesn't ask him what he was doing. There's no yelp from her. She looks at him calmly and says, "Go get cleaned up. I'll take care of your clothes." She reminds him to take his shoes off so that he won't track blood in the house. And the calm way that she takes control of the situation to care for her house was really fascinating to me. You know, and they could have fleshed her character out much more. Mm-hmm. She's mostly seen in the movie smoking.
Looking good.
Looking great in all of these beautiful outfits.
Royalty.
She's described as being, her family came over on the quote-quote Italian Mayflower, which I love that line. You know, but of course, there's no doubt that many of the characters, if not all of the female characters, could have been fleshed out in a very real way. And there's sort of these shadows that are lingering for all the men, but there are these really powerful shadows nonetheless. Buffalino's wife, one and only one, unfortunately, of Frank Sheeran's daughters, really holds sway over him. The one that rejects him. The one that never speaks to him.
And in fact has been pointed out to never speak. In contrast to a character like Diane Keaton's character in Godfather and Godfather 2, which has been referenced as a powerful voice of kind of horror and resistance to this brutal and corrupt world.
But everyone
world.
Has to remember, you know, her character, the person that she plays, she's an outsider to this Italian family. So she's pulled in. She's not one of them. So she doesn't understand the dynamics. She doesn't know what people do, that this is just what you do. Frank's family understands exactly what he does. His daughters know. His wife, both of his wives, knew exactly what he was doing, and they never questioned it.
Well, we could argue, though, that Frank, as the Irishman, they are outsiders, which puts them in a position of being able to have a certain lens,
but not one
that's super developed.
I would say they are outsiders. They're not an Italian family, but especially in that time, I have to also remind people, you know, that close of an Irish family still identified as immigrants themselves, you know, and then Mark and I, we spoke about how Frank Sheeran was in the war. He spent that time in Italy. He was fluent in Italian. You know, and so that was one of the hooks that helped pull him in, you know, so, and it was that scene where he's speaking Italian is actually a really gorgeous scene. There's wine, there's bread, and they're just leaning close talking about, you know, all the conflict in the war and what you do. And Frank says, you do what you have to do. You let the prisoners dig their own grave. It's really an intense scene.
Yeah, and it's a war crime. Yeah. So his criminal background is pretty well established at that point, but those are acceptable war crimes. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's been more female dialogue on this radio show right now than there was in the entire Irishman.
Exactly.
So quickly with our last minute, I did want to mention in kind of a little bit of a pushback on some of the critiques of the, you know, I get why people don't want to see more films about brutal white men, but we have to remember that Italians, however we think about that right now, white ethnics, etc., let's just place ourselves and say Italians were not white. And Jimmy Hoffa makes it very clear what position they hold in his mind over and over again with the insults and the routine jabs at them. That Italians were immigrants, and that Scorsese has made a career out of exploring what he understands to be America through that lens and through the mob movie. And in that way, as a person who loves mob movies for whatever reason, and has an Italian father and a union guy, I love them. So unfortunately, I got to wrap it up right now. Victoria Saucedo, thank you for being with us.
Thank
Mark
you.
Brenner, we're going to make you come in studio well more often now that you live in Oregon. Thanks
love
for
it.
Being here.
Thank you for having me.
The Old Mole, we're talking about The Irishman this morning. We're wrapping it up for this morning. I want to thank all of our guests and contributors. Bill Resnick and Brian Tokar. We had Desiree Helliger's Robin White and Shelley Sasasi. I'm not going to remember how to say that, so I apologize. They were talking about the Dakota Reservation, so we'll have this show posted up on the web, kboo.fm, Old Mole Variety Hour, and we'll be back next week.